Hear ye, the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Our first case is 2020-290, the State of Ohio versus Sherry Tidwell. For the appellant, first we'll have Mr. Cummings argue. Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Supreme Court. I would like to speak for 8 minutes and then reserve 5 minutes for amicus. And then additionally, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes at the end for a rebuttal, if I may. Your Honors, the case before you today was a perfectly proper, constitutionally reasonable stop. The trial court got this issue wrong, and so did the Court of Appeals. And the reason's clear. Both courts misapprehended the legal significance of an on-site citizen contact with a police officer. And because both courts misapprehended the significance of that citizen informant contact, they miscategorized this case as an anonymous tip case, and it's not. It's a citizen informant case. And once they miscategorized this as an anonymous tip case, the die was cast because they went down the road that pretty much dismissing everything else, all the other circumstantial evidence, and pretty much said, hey, this person was unidentified and unnamed. This is unreliable. Therefore, the search and the stop is unconstitutional. And Your Honors, that is just legally wrong. And it's against common sense as well. And quite frankly, it's quite dangerous. So this court today has an excellent opportunity not only to correct the error in this case, but to reaffirm the concept that citizen informant cases like this deserve special consideration. The tips of a citizen in this type of situation, they are entitled to deference. They are considered of higher reliability, and that's for a reason. These reasons have been stated by this court actually in Wisner, and that's the basis for the three-step category that we use to categorize tips. I know this court is aware of that. The most unreliable is the anonymous tip. And then you have the known informant type tip, which is usually somebody that's worked with police before of the criminal world. So they have a history of perhaps providing reliable information, but they're not really all that reliable, and you want some cooperation if you can get it. Certainly you want cooperation with an anonymous tip. But the third and the most reliable type of tip is that of the concerned citizen, the citizen informant. And I think that unfortunately in this case, because the name of this person was not in the record and the officer did not identify this person before leaving the scene, both of the courts below grabbed on that. And that was basically determinative of their analysis. And that's quite unfortunate because that's not what the totality of circumstances analysis contemplates. And it certainly is not dictated by the record that was developed in this particular case. The factors that we had in this case that justified the officer's actions are overwhelming in favor of the officer taking the steps he did. The citizen approached him. The citizen initiated contact. He looked at the officer. The officer looked at the citizen, and the citizen yelled, hey, you need to stop that lady. She's drunk and she's about to drive, essentially. And so at that moment, what did the officer have? He knew that he had the report of a crime, possibly not one of a past commission, but one that was ongoing. This is in real time. He had an identified person in an identified vehicle. She was parked in her Hummer, and it was in a specific location. He knew all that. He also knew, or, you know, the law knows at this point, that the citizen who just stepped forward is entitled to great reliability. And in a case like this, where the allegation is so serious and has such potential public safety consequences, the need to act on such information is apparent, and it's encouraged by the case law. And at this point in time, the officer was absolutely justified in taking this seriously and doing the very minimal step of at least walking towards this woman and looking at her and seeing what he could determine.
Mr. Cummings?
Yes.
So I was trying to clarify the facts. So she was in a Hummer, an H3. So did he actually reach in and take her keys out of the ignition once she rolled down her window and stopped backing out?
No, I think he requested the keys, and I think she handed the keys to him. But that was after a period of time. He first looked at her, I think, before she noticed him, and he noticed her blank stare and her glassy eyes. And then he got her attention, and he motioned for her to stop, and she did. And at that point in time, I think we have to realize that this is an investigatory detention at this point. And I think that can be clearly conceded, but I think it's also clearly justifiable, because everything that he knew justified him taking the minimal step that he did. And then the longer time he spent interacting with her, the reasonable suspicion, the probable cause just increased.
So what I'm trying to get at, because yes, this is a really close case, what I'm trying to get at is, at what point did he ask for her keys? Had he smelled alcohol, or was it just the blank stare and the backing slowly when he asked for the keys?
Sequentially, I think it was after he struck up a conversation with her. He asked her where she's been, what she's been doing. He asked for her license. I think it took some awkward seconds, almost maybe a minute, I think he said, for her to pull out her license. It was a very unusually slow and prolonged process. And I think by the time he smelled the alcohol, at that point he was smelling the alcohol and noticing her exaggerated slow movements. And I think it was after those things occurred that he asked for her keys, and she handed those to him. He took them on top of her car, I believe.
And just to be clear, she had already moved the vehicle. The vehicle was in motion when he stopped her.
Correct. She was starting to slowly back out of wherever she was parked. Okay. And I know that's been mentioned, that is not per se erratic driving, and, you know, taken alone, that's a neutral thing, and I understand that. Yet the case law says even innocent actions, sometimes taken in context, can further reasonable suspicion. So that cuts both ways here. In hindsight, she was moving very, very slowly in everything she did, not just backing up the Hummer, but in fumbling with her license and trying to comply with his requests. Her exaggerated slowness was just a corroboration that the citizen informant was dead on. This woman was drunk.
Would it have been unreasonable for the police officer to follow her to see if her driving was erratic?
Absolutely. I mean, this, when you have corroborated information of a drunk woman who's about to pull into a public street.
Let's just say a drunk person.
Okay, but I'm sorry. A drunk person in a big vehicle, the public safety here is, you must balance that, and it weighs heavily in favor of taking the action the officer did. You have to eliminate the risk of that type of drunk driving immediately. He would have been remiss had he not. I'm sorry.
Also, what you had here is exigent circumstances. Would you not agree?
Yes, in a way, yes. I mean, you're talking about it. It's a balancing act. Delaware versus Prowse says you have to balance the intrusion with the governmental interest involved. And in a case like this, where a driver is about to go out drunk and drive on the public roadways, that's an exigent circumstance. Absolutely. In the sense that it presents a very, very dangerous situation that must be considered.
Do we know if the officer was finished with the business that he was originally there for? I mean, was he still kind of between both scenarios? I believe he had pulled over someone and he was doing something else official when he got the information about the potential drunk driver.
I think he was finishing up. I don't think he was completely finished. Okay. Yes. I'm sorry, I can see that I've gone over time. I'd like to step aside now and let Mr. Carney speak if I could.
Mr. Carney.
Thank you. Good morning, may it please the court. Two principles govern this case, and they're both uncontroversial on their own. And the way they interplayed here don't undercut either one, either the citizen informant rule or the snapshot rule. And together they show this tip was reliable and Sergeant Alon did the right thing when he stopped Tidwell before she drove off drunk. The citizen informant rule, as the state already explained, is that you're presumptively reliable. You don't count as anonymous just because you haven't had time to give your name yet. The snapshot rule that this court's discussed in Dayton v. Erickson and a host of cases is that we judge everything by the split second where the officer has to decide, not by after acquired evidence. And I think that's what threw the lower court off here, because most of the time that rule cuts against the state. When the state doesn't have enough evidence for a stop and they try to point to, well, it turns out someone was drunk or turns out there were drugs in the car, the courts rightly say, no, you can't judge how it played out. You have to judge in the moment. And I think the best way to resolve this case is imagine it happened the same way to start. Someone yells, stop that car, that lady's drunk. And then it turns out after he stops the car and freezes that situation that he goes over and this witness has pulls out an ID and tells this full detailed story of, I saw her stumble in the store. She slurred her speech. She threw up on my shoes, you know, all sorts of detail. Well, that case might seem stronger, but it's not, because legally that's the identical case at the time he heard someone say, stop, she's drunk. And where the appeals court was wrong is in saying, well, the tip should have had more detail. The Kansas Supreme Court did a really nice job in the Slater case explaining this, that a conclusory statement like she's drunk is the kind of thing that lay people know. They don't tend to itemize, especially with the urgency of, you know, death and danger, right? Any second now, you don't tend to list specific things about slurred speech. We all know drunkenness when we see it, and we don't need a Rule 703, you know, expert qualification to opine that someone is drunk. There's also no time for that detail. And I think if we all ask, what do we want the next Sergeant Alonzo to do tomorrow? We know what that answer is. He may have saved a life here. He may have saved Sherry Tilgrove's life. And so that's why waiting for something else would not have been reasonable. And again, if you just judge by that moment in time, this case is very straightforward, because we know the citizen informant rule from Wisner. We know the moment in time rule from Erickson. And this is a matter of just putting them together. The other thing is, if you zoom out and you think, is this reasonable? We know what that answer is. But if you zoom in more and ask, we have these classifications of anonymous or known informant or citizen informant, but really those are just shorthand for characteristics that this court discussed in Wisner of, is there veracity? Is there reliability? And here, all those things, no reason to lie, immediacy, those all cut in favor of allowing this stop here. Again, you know, she turned out at a 0.213. We didn't know that at the moment, but we knew someone getting in a Hummer, that is life or death. We all want that situation to be stopped immediately. We should be thankful Sergeant Alonzo did the right thing here, and this court should uphold the stop and again reaffirm that a citizen informant is presumptively reliable, as this citizen was here.
But Mr. Kearney, what if that unidentified person had been wrong? And this is a case that's so specific on the facts. And if we turn this into basically a rule with our decision, then what about the person who's wrongfully detained in the future based on what amounts to an unidentified person who got the information from somebody else and then called out to the police officer, and the police officer went ahead and detained the person just based on that? I mean, are we harming people that way too?
There are two answers to that, Your Honor, and I'll try to be really quick because I want to save Mr. Cummings' rebuttal time. But first, that's why the court says presumptively reliable. If there's actually some affirmative indicia of unreliability, then there might be some tipping point where you can't do the stop. But what this court says in balancing, this is such a minimal stop, don't roll off yet, that the worst thing that happens is if you go over to the car and she's perfectly fine, she goes on her way.
He took her keys. He took her keys, and it's okay to stop and have a consensual encounter, which is what it could have been at first. But once he took her keys, she was detained.
Well, Your Honor, the most important thing here is the initial stop where he says, don't drive off yet. Once he started talking to her, he did notice then the speech. He did talk about her glassy stare. He asked her for the keys and she handed them over. At that point, he was witnessing that firsthand, but he also had a witness, a citizen informant. That doesn't count as anonymous. When you're in public, you don't count as anonymous just because you haven't shown an ID yet. And that is enough to say this person is drunk. After all, they didn't go to a full-scale arrest till the other officer came, a sheriff's deputy, and did a drunk test. People get pulled over and asked to do drunk tests. I was once years ago, and I was perfectly sober, hadn't had a drink, and then I was let to go on my way. I did get a speeding ticket. But I did not, if you're not drunk, you don't have a problem. If it turns out, you know, there are stops that turn out nothing's wrong here. You know, if someone was just weaving because they changed the station or something on their car, you know, there are times that there are missed calls or mistaken calls. The question is, do we want to err on the side of safety or do we want to risk life or death? And here we are on the side of safety. We have other tools designed if rules get abused, but here the officer, you know, turned out right. The citizen was right. And again, we may have saved a life that day. And I think we all want the next Sergeant Alons to do the right thing and stop someone.
Mr. Carney, but Justice Stewart suggested maybe he could have followed her.
Well, this is a busy intersection on Montgomery Road in Cincinnati, pulling out of a speedway. I respectfully suggest that it's one thing when someone's already driving to say, can I risk? And even then, this court in Wisner said, continuing to drive and follow wasn't necessary because someone reported that a car was weaving. But if you have a chance to stop someone before they pull out in traffic, to say, just pull out, I'll rush into my car and follow and hope for the best. You know, if I were driving on the street that day or my loved ones were, I wouldn't want the officer to wait longer. If they didn't have reliable information, sure. But when someone says that lady is drunk, again, the average citizen knows what drunk looks like. And so that is shorthand, as the Kansas Supreme Court put it, shorthand for the things that even the appeals court said here. This might have been good enough in the appeals court view if he had specified, I saw her drink several alcoholic beverages. Well, I don't think we need to engage in that fiction of saying, we don't understand out of common sense. When you say someone's drunk, that means they've consumed several beverages. That means they've exhibited some physical signs, whether it's speech or whether it's stumbling movement or something.
Counsel, wasn't the testimony that the clerk in the store was alerted to her intoxication and I believe still sold her alcohol and then immediately remorseful, I guess, or scared, tells this other customer, hey, this woman's drunk. I mean, he gave some direction to the, so it was upon two observations, not just the citizen informant.
Well, Your Honor, that is all absolutely true. It did turn out that instead of the usual buyer's remorse, we had, I suppose, seller's remorse, that the clerk said, you know, get that cop because he saw the lights out there and relayed it. I think the important thing, though, is while that does further corroborate what happened here, that I have to take the good with the bad, that if you judge by the snapshot rule, as I call it, that when the officer had to decide in this split second,
right. He
didn't know any of that. So this case is the same, whether it turned out that the customer was relaying what the clerk said, or the customer had seen it himself, or as I said, if the customer had seen some outrageous set of stumbling and slurring and, you know, drinking in the hall of, in the aisle at the store, none of that matters because just saying conclusorily, she's drunk, incorporates a set of common sense human judgments of that must mean someone is dangerous. For example, one of the things the appeals court said is, well, this tip contained no predictive information. When you say stop that car, that lady's drunk, the prediction is implicit. If she gets in that car, she's going to drive drunk and someone's going to get hurt. You don't have to say it in so many words and use too many words like I do. You can just say stop, drunk. And that's the bottom line here.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Brittingham.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Merely having a line of sight with a police officer does not transform an otherwise anonymous individual into a citizen informant. Appellant has defined a citizen informant as not an anonymous tip and not a known informant. If the unidentified individual here is not anonymous, then there is no anonymous. Reasonable suspicion is the undisputed standard here. In Borum and Wisner relied upon heavily by appellant, the court stated that an eyewitness account of criminal activity is due greater reliability than a secondhand description.
Mr. Brittington, how is he anonymous if the person is right there in front of the police officer's face?
Well, when the Supreme Court was looking at Navarette, so a lot of the cases by both sides deal with callers, and other cases cited by both sides deal with in-person individuals. In Navarette, Justice Scalia, in his dissent, noticed that law enforcement officers are likely to take away from that case that anonymous 911 accusations are not as suspect and hence as unreliable as other anonymous accusations.
Let me ask you this. You know, when I read the facts of this case, I couldn't help but wonder or analogize hearsay exceptions. You know, the reasons we allow hearsay exceptions is they contain certain indicia of truthfulness, like an excited utterance. How does this situation not differ from that? You know, an anonymous tipster calling in might have all sorts of nefarious reasons for doing so. But in our common experience, usually people don't come out and say, make an accusation in person that is false. Would you not agree with that?
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. I'm glad you brought up the hearsay analysis, because what we have here is hearsay upon hearsay, because we have the clerk from the Speedway relaying information to the individual, and the individual relaying that information to Trooper Eilands. Also, below, there was no testimony elicited as to the tone of the tip. Was it matter of fact? Was it excited? Was it urgent? There was no testimony
Again, what difference does that make if the person is in front of the police officer and says that person is about to drive drunk?
Correct. But in Wisner, in Oney, in Ramey, all cited by appellant, the individuals in those cases made concerted efforts to seek out this officer. And that's not really what we have here. We have a passing 2-second statement where the person, the unidentified individual, relayed information to Trooper Eilands, and then he left the scene never to be seen again.
Well, why is that the state's fault or the police officer's fault that the citizen informant left the scene?
Well, Trooper Eilands could have done several other things here. He could have, I'm sorry, I'm switching my notes here. He could have asked for a name. He could have asked the unidentified individual to stick around.
But doesn't that all cut against your argument? Because at the time that the person made those statements, he didn't know, she didn't know that the officer wasn't going to say, wait right there until this is over, right? So, you know, there's a lot more risk lying to a police officer when you're face to face with the police officer. The police officer can stop, can make you wait. You don't know what the officer's going to say than someone in the typical anonymous cases that you rely upon where it's just a phone call.
Well, that could be, Your Honor. However, if in person always equated to truthfulness, then we wouldn't have a need for statutes like obstruction of official business or falsification or perjury.
But it doesn't have to always equate to truthfulness. That's not the standard here. The standard is there just has to be a reasonable suspicion. Is someone who is saying something to a police officer's face, is that enough to create reasonable suspicion?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. We're told over and over again that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. Do you think it would have been reasonable for a police officer who's just been told that someone who is intoxicated is getting ready to drive a Hummer into a busy traffic to just let that person go?
Well, Your Honor, if the officer sees a person pulling out of a bar at closing time, he may suspect that person's been drinking.
But that's different. That's not the facts here. This is where someone has told the officer that person is drunk. Do you think it would be reasonable? Do you think a reasonable police officer would allow that person to pull out into traffic in that situation?
Well, and that's not the standard either, Your Honor.
Well, the overriding standard of the Fourth Amendment is reasonable. So I'm just asking, do you think it would have been reasonable to allow this person to pull out into traffic after the officer had been told that that person was driving drunk?
I think it would certainly be reasonable to say, hey, can you stick around? Hey, what's your name? Those things take no time at all. And in those situations, we have a lot more information. We have
Counselor, let's assume for the sake of argument, the police officer said, thank you for the information. Can you wait right here? And went on and did exactly what he did with Ms. Tidwell. But the citizen informant or the person who gave the information did not stay around. Does that make this case different?
I think if the person didn't stick around, then yes, I think that cuts in my favor.
Because, why?
Because then if a defendant flees from the scene, the state's entitled to a jury instruction that flight from the scene is consciousness of guilt.
But the informant is not a defendant.
Correct, but by analogy. And if he's asked to stick around and doesn't, then I think that takes away from the veracity that should be given to that person.
Why?
Because he would not,
counsel, if the officer goes about his duty under Justice Stewart's scenario, then the after having requested, not ordered, but requested the informant to stick around, and the informant leaves, that does an impact on what was said to the officer to give them the reasonable suspicion to act, nor what subsequently flowed from that. The observation of the glassy eyes, the exaggerated movements, the blank stare, that all comes afterwards.
I guess it does depend on the timing, Your Honor. If Trooper Eilands would have said, hey, please stick around, and the person said, no, I'm leaving right away, I guess that's something that's known before the stop. But if he asked the person to stick around, while I would say that's a more reasonable thing to do than nothing, then I would agree with your point.
But Mr. Bradington, don't we want to encourage citizens to, particularly matters involving safety, don't we want to encourage citizens to notify law enforcement? I mean, don't we want to discourage people standing idly by and not reporting something suspicious, as you know, as said by the your opposing counsel, their lives that could have been saved from this.
So, yes, the phrase from appellant's brief was, "If you see something, say something." But it's important to keep in mind that there's no evidence below, or anywhere, that this person actually saw or observed or witnessed anything. They were merely told by the Speedway clerk to tell Trooper Eilands this information. So.
But that doesn't mean that the informant didn't see for his or herself that Ms. Tidwell was intoxicated.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but that would be presuming a fact not in the record. And of course, it's appellant's burden at this point, and that evidence was not presented below.
Okay.
Mr. Brittingham,
yes.
Do you agree that she voluntarily handed her keys to the officer and he didn't take them out of the ignition, correct?
He did not take them out of the ignition, is my understanding. He said, give me your keys. So I guess voluntarily giving them to her, I may slightly disagree, but he said, give me your keys, and she gave him her keys.
Thank you.
So what happens if this person, the officer had done nothing, he's ignored the tip, the person pulls out into traffic, kills someone? Don't you think that there would be a lawsuit against the police saying that the police officer was reckless for ignoring the tip that someone was drunk, was about to pull onto the highway?
first of all, how would that tip come to light? The tipster is unknown. No one would ever know that the tip was even made.
That's not really the point, though. Maybe the officer told someone. Maybe the clerk told someone. But
I guess I fail to see the relevance here in the determination as to why.
It seems pretty relevant if we would think that it was misconduct by the police not to do something here. So,
well, I think it's important not to get lost here that we've got a state patrol officer acting on entirely private property. And under 5503.02 of the Ohio Revised Code, he doesn't have jurisdiction to even stop someone on private property. So I would think that would absolve him, and I don't practice in personal injury or any of those areas, but I would think that would absolve him of potential liability and that he didn't even have jurisdiction to stop the person.
So an officer, a state trooper, cannot react to a crime being committed if it's on private property and not a highway. Is that what you're saying?
That's what 5503.02 says.
The crime is, well, does that, the sheriff was there, right? Didn't the sheriff follow up on this?
The sheriff didn't arrive until about 5 minutes later. And she was detained after Trooper Islands had taken her keys. She was detained for that time.
So you think any arrest that occurs in a public parking lot owned by a business is illegal? Is that what you're saying?
In State v. Brown, this court looked at a situation where a township officer from Township A witnesses a traffic violation in Township B, and the court analyzed the statute that granted the township officer the police powers and said, even with probable cause and even with observing that traffic violation, there's no jurisdiction to stop that motorist and to stop and everything after was suppressed. So in the same situation here, 5503.02 grants state patrol troopers their police powers, and it grants power on state roads, highways, and government or state-owned land, none of which we have here. So I think that would likely.
Did you raise that argument below?
I did. And the motion to suppress was granted in its entirety. So the state chose to focus on this issue, but I want to point out to the court that the appellant focuses the court's attention in the wrong direction here. OBI prevention is a laudatory goal, but the proper analysis or the proper framing is Ms. Tidwell's constitutional right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure versus appellant's interest in having Trooper Island stop someone without statutory jurisdiction to do so based on an anonymous tip. Now, Terry requires reasonable suspicion based on specific articulable facts before a stop will pass constitutional muster. And here, there's no specificity. There's no facts here. There's much less articulable facts. There's simply a secondhand opinion. In the first paragraph of its argument, appellant frames Terry as affording protections to the public. That's an incorrect and misleading interpretation of the Supreme Court's holding in that case. Terry protects individuals from stops and searches without reasonable suspicion. And that twisting of Terry is required to find in favor of the appellant here. To find for appellant, you need to say that OBI prevention is so important that reasonable suspicion is no longer required to stop a motorist. An appellant seems to realize that based on its framing of Terry in such a way. Of course, this would be a deviation from 53 years of jurisprudence. In Florida v. J.L., the Supreme Court rejected a firearm exception to the reasonable suspicion requirement laid out in Terry. An appellant is essentially asking the court to carve out an OBI exception to that reasonable suspicion requirement. I'm out of time, so I'll close by saying just merely having a line of sight with a police officer does not transform an otherwise anonymous individual into a citizen.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, well, you've used your time, or Mr. Kearney has used your time, so I'll give you a minute. You'll have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. A couple of quick points. The jurisdictional issue is not before this court. It wasn't addressed by the Court of Appeals. And specifically on page 84 of the trial court's decision, the trial court rejected that basis of the motion to suppress. So that's not properly addressed by this court this time. Justice Bruner, I know you mentioned about what rule of law we're interested in. The state's not interested in this court creating a new bright line rule of law. I think the whole beauty of the totality of circumstances test is just that. Every case has to have its be weighed individually. I think what we're asking, though, is for this court to reject the appellee's request for a bright line rule and the courts below. They seem to think that if you don't have a name for a citizen informant at the scene, then this is going to be an anonymous tip situation. That's not accurate. That's not the case law. And that's the bright line rule that we think is so important that this court push back against and send that message to the courts of the state of Ohio, because this is going to happen again and again and again. And we cannot have a type of confusion where officers are hesitant to stop somebody from driving drunk just because they don't have the name of the citizen who's standing in front of them and they forgot to get it. Basically, the officers, they're here to protect and serve, and that's their business. That's why they put the uniform and the badge on every day. And in a situation like this, the officer did exactly what the public would hope and expect the officer to do. And I hope that this court sees fit to send a message that his actions were reasonable, they were constitutionally sound, admirable, and this is the way to conduct an investigation under circumstances like this, where you have no reason not to doubt the citizen informant. And real quickly, to your point, Justice Stewart, I think if the person makes an affirmative attempt to maintain their anonymity at the scene, I think that certainly would weigh in the totality of circumstances analysis, but we don't have that here. This citizen did his duty. Ostensibly, the officer assumed he was doing the duty that you know a concerned citizen would do. So in this case, it certainly cuts in favor of the officer taking action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.